Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host
Carl5872.
All right, guests, time to introduce the show. Maybe we need to clarify who the guest is. We had this problem last time.
Oh, that's me.
They're so used to listening, they don't realize they're the guest.
Okay, welcome to episode number 230 with Makalua.
This extra caffeinated version of Mackie brought to you by the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Woo! Racing,
Daniel,
sorry.
Daniel Quick.
Blah-de-blah. Blah.
The Mian Team.
I have all the listener support, right?
Mad Jin.
Hi.
And I'm your guest host, Carl.
And yes, he is the only Carl on the internet.
Hmm. It's kind of similar to how Mackie's the only one.
I knew that joke was coming. Ah.
Thank you, Phil.
Well, when Dan sets it up, you know how it is, Mackie.
Why does the AI settle cities directly next to yours in Civilization V? They're just trying to get fresh? No, wait, no.
Because they're jerks?
Sunbeam asks, I guess it is self-explanatory. It seems to me that it, of course it being the artificial intelligence or AI, will pass up better city spots to settle directly next to you. Is this some kind of eventual war strategy or something? Because I sure don't get it. Well, to quote actually Ghost Stu a little later down in the thread, to secure the high-value city location for itself and to deny you the same. Of course, it's denying you the opportunity to settle there, although you may decide you don't want to settle there, and it's not necessarily a high-value city location. The AI is like, oh, I don't have that luxury yet, but is that city going to be any good? Is it going to be able to support itself? Is it going to be able to grow? Oh, but it's a luxury resource I don't have. So, plunk.
Yeah, it's also more like it, not just that city location that it's denying you. It's denying you more space, too.
The second post in this thread is there's a boldness setting for them. The higher boldness that they have, the higher priority they have settling next to you. So as the poster said, some are literally hardwired to settle next to you.
That means other civs, any other civ.
Yeah, not specifically.
Not specifically the human player, but any other civilization nearby. Oh, they're next to there. Let me go cuddle up with them.
Yeah, so that you deny them settling space in that direction, or just prepare for war.
Even then, though, having the city next to the person's capital is advantageous, assuming you can hold it long enough to build units.
Mm-hmm. And I think capitals are just inherently better, like as far as like the concentration of resources. So even if they looked at like a blank map, they would settle towards where capitals are because there's nicer things there.
Yep. The map script makes sure that capitals and city-states take the good stuff first.
And inevitably, the threat also evolves into, so what exactly do we do about this other than complain?
Kill it.
Well, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So, oh, I see that settler. You think you're going to settle towards me, huh? Well, I prefer this squish strategy, where I now get a free worker by capturing it. It's especially delicious if they don't even protect it. I mean, that's being arrogant and stupid.
That's either true.
Either that, or you do what other people already said in the thread, which is basically get some units of your own out and block areas.
Yep. Especially scouts in harsh terrain, it's really hard to get around that without fighting. Yep. And the AI won't just declare on you just to move through.
Humans would, but the AI won't.
Yeah. Humans will, but they will make sure they have more units, or at least sufficient units to actually kill yours while attacking them into harsh terrain. So, yes, humans will eventually, but they probably won't just take a standard small settling party and try to declare on you to get through because it won't work.
No.
If you're also finding that it looks like, hey, you're trying to go past where my city is located and try to, you know, embed yourself between two or more of your cities, it's very situational. I think this also works better with the AI as opposed to another human. You could buy some tiles to block them in combination with military units or otherwise if you don't have military units in the vicinity.
You're provided that they are trying to pass a city that you can buy tiles with.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they do that all the time. Hey, can I get open borders? No. But
no, I know exactly why you want them. You can't ask.
But there's that city spot on the other side of you. Yeah,
no,
go away.
That's mine.
Mine.
I do enjoy Historic 69's comment where there seems to be no longtime negative diplo modifiers if you capture a settler, since a settler seems to count as a unit and not as a city. Well, about that, it is still just a unit.
Yep.
It doesn't even stay a settler. It turns into a worker.
Now, Shaka Khan, and I'm not just quoting what they've had to say so I could say that and in that way, although that was definitely a bonus. He says, I suggest not removing barb encampments proximal to where you want to settle. Then rather than declaring war on someone and steal his settler or her settler, come on now, you can send out your own settler when you're good and ready, accompanied by a small, efficient military group to remove the barb camp, get a small chunk of change, and get a free worker for your new city. I think that's kind of situational. If the barb encampment is there and you don't have another meaningful way to block it, and it's kind of one of those, well, I don't want to settle out that way anyway, or I don't want to settle out there now, then there is that, but I'd rather be a little bit more proactive than that. That seems a little too reactive.
You also take the risk that the AI doesn't actually send out its own war party to go take out that barb camp, because it will do that. And that also assumes that the settler is not being protected, which the AI tends to do. Even if the space is empty, it'll still try and protect it.
This is more likely to work when the AI doesn't have hammer bonuses that it gets on the higher levels and starting units. So it's more likely to get caught with like just one unit that gets killed by barbs or not use them or that kind of thing. And it's slower to kill the barb camp, so you have more time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we're talking multiplayer instead of single player and we substitute AI for human, why does the human settle cities directly next to yours? Is this some kind of eventual war strategy? Yes.
Yes. But most actions they take are part of something that will eventually lead to a war strategy.
Full stop.
But that one's particularly bad because it makes conflict between you and that player more likely as opposed to virtually anybody else other than other people who also forward settle you. So.
And isn't it always enjoyable when the AI does that and then they're like, our close borders spark tension.
Yeah,
about that.
Hello? If you didn't want close borders, you shouldn't settle right next to me. Duh.
I don't know, though. Like, because that kind of resembles human play, it doesn't bother me as much as some of the other things about the AI. Because people who want to kill you do that, too.
I started off this topic by saying the AI is just trying to get fresh with you, and there is a fine line between love and hate. So when they say they do not like you for having, you know, close borders sparking tensions, again, I think that's just about getting fresh.
Your capital's in the way of my expansion direction.
This was demands to the AI because I demand the AI stop being an idiot, but too good to me. It was writing that sometimes the AI asks you to help them out through the demand diplomacy thing. You can fulfill their request to get a diplomatic boost of them for a while. Is it possible for the player to demand something to the AI? He says he tried it when he was allied. Even one gull, they act as if it's a major offense. Oh my gosh. Now he tried it with like military and all of their borders and they were frightened by me, but they still don't want to give him one gold. Seems like this button is just to get them mad at you.
Yep. There's a pretty big asymmetrical design within the diplomacy system. The AI is allowed to do all sorts of stuff to you and ask for things and demand you tell them about your units on their border. But if you even remotely think about it, you'll find that most of those options either don't even exist or, it just makes the AI mad at you.
Yeah, because I would like to be able to demand about the AI about their units on my border.
Yeah. You know that stupid prophet? Piss off.
Yeah, there's one. That swarm of prophets and missionaries coming this way, get them the hell off.
Yes, our diplomatic option is reactive after it spreads to one or more of your cities. And then you can say, stop it!
Well, the proactive action is just to declare war on them and kill their missionaries, but...
Well,
yeah, we have to let our soldiers do the talking.
It's certainly true that the AI has diplomatic options. We don't. Not that it uses them well, but they're there.
And Delnar Erzseek goes into across a couple of posts into elaborate description, where he does also talk about there are basically two ways you can demand from the AI, air quotes. Either demand when you two are at peace or demand as a peace treaty. These two go through completely separate types of logic, with certain items being valued higher or lower in one case than the other. He cites open borders valued higher in peacetime demand, whereas gold per turn valued higher in demand for a peace treaty, which really makes sense. For peacetime demands, the AI will never be willing to give up any cities. Well, that seems,
seems
fair enough. That seems fair enough. You have to have, and he goes into a whole bunch of math, but we won't repeat it on this show.
Hey, he did the math for us.
Yeah, there's a fail exception error if we try to read math on the show, so we won't do that. It boils down to a roll of the dice to a degree. But there's also some stuff in there, such as, for example, if an AI's military might is roughly 85% of the player's military might, they will never give in. And then, of course, there's my favorite, which is the AI will never give in to any demands from the same player for a number of turns, even if the initial demand was too much. So if you actually want them to give in and your first demand was ridiculous and then your second one would be more than agreeable until a certain time has lapsed, then it's like, okay, you're asking for something again so soon? How dare you?
Yeah, how about you go away now?
For me, the demand is it's either a Hail Mary or I'm trying to get some negative modifiers because I want them to declare on me as opposed to the other way around. Very situational. Most of the time, I just do it for the lulls. I just do it to piss them off because I don't care one way or the other. It's like, oh, you're already really dark red negative against me. What's one more tick? Who cares?
Yeah, so the AI can demand, or they can also go, hey, buddy, can you give me a loon? And it hurts relations when you say no. Because they always ask for, like, ridiculous amounts of stuff.
Yes.
Give me half your luxuries. No. Yeah.
Like, I have no happiness problems, but I wouldn't mind an extra 20 plus happiness worth of luxuries. And you not having them anymore because it's your last copy. But you're buddy, right?
Exactly. Even if a human player did that to me, I'd be like, hell no.
Actually, my favorite thing on those dialogues when the AI demands something is I don't, strictly speaking, respond. I just press the escape button.
Oh, you just let him go to voicemail, huh?
I take it the game counts that as refusing the demand.
Actually, it might be an exploit.
Oh.
Well, part of me was about to say, I've never seen it and say you refused at when I hit escape.
Oh,
so.
I see. That's good to know. And I usually just abuse AI anyway, but even so, if I happen to care for some reason, then that sounds useful.
And of course, if they are demanding too much from you, then go wipe them out, then they can't demand anything anymore.
Yeah. They won't do it while they're at war either. They'll just beg for peace.
You get to demand to them.
Yep.
Oh, I know. If it's really, really annoying you, then what you can do is you can start a multiplayer game just with yourself. And then you'll never have to demand anything because in MP those dialogues don't come up.
That's true too, actually. And they don't get angry if you station like all the units at their borders either. Few questions about religions. This is started by Doc Rock. Hey guys, I finally found the time to play some Civ again, and I have a few questions about religions. Current game is with Spain. Their and has an insane amount of faith per turn, about 120, and I just hit the industrial era.
That's not an insane amount of faith per turn. That's the industrial era.
Well, let's just continue for the moment.
Yes.
We deconstruct all the things at once.
It's a relative number, perhaps, compared to their faith output.
My neighbor Attila had just founded the final religion, so his capital is now his religion. All his other cities believe in mine. Will he be angry if I propose the world religion? As another poster said, yes. 1A, would it be a good idea to use a great prophet on his capital? I feel no. And then his other question is that he went to tradition and piety for Jesuit education and then into rationalism, but he's not sure which victory condition to follow. Is there one that is tailored towards religious dominance? I think there is, but the ship has sailed on it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, maybe he'll just kill everything or go science. Either way, that would work. That would be my answer to the number two. Yeah, the thing about religion is you can go piety for that one that gives tourism super early before anyone else gets any tourism.
But he went Jesuit education.
Jesuit education, so that's off the table. That is the one that I would say is quote-unquote tailored towards religious dominance.
The sacred sites?
Yeah.
But in this case, if he's trying to propose world religion, then he's also trying to get extra votes in the diplomatic victory side of things.
Yeah, that's true. Go for diplo.
Either that or just trying to get extra votes to do what it is that you want to do, whether it's diplomatic or not.
Yeah.
And yes, we are talking about the World Congress, by the way. That wasn't actually included in the OP. Tisk tisk.
Yeah. I think most of the time, if someone's founded a religion in their capital, it's not worth your time to great profit it because it eventually flips back. And so I feel like the faith is more useful even if you just settle it in most cases. But if you want that religion gone, yeah, conquer it and then throw the Inquisition in there. That'll take care of things nicely.
Now, he could go convert Attila's capital, and that will prevent Attila from buying Inquisitors. Period. He'd have to get another great prophet to cleanse his own capital. Because if all those other cities are covered with the player's religion, and Attila only gets his capital...
You wouldn't be able to buy one, you're right.
Because both missionaries and inquisitors' religion is based on the city's religion, not based on the civ's religion.
And if he just got that profit, it's very likely that he's not making much faith per turn, so it would take him a lot longer to generate the inquisitors and profits needed to just purge the posters' religion from his capital.
Since Attila just got the last religion, probably not going to be able to do it. And if he just got the first part of the religion, he doesn't even have the second part, which means he can't buy inquisitors yet, because he only just started the religion. Still has to keep going with it to be able to get to inquisitors, which means three great profits.
Oh, yeah. Depending on how much you care about your religion spread to him, which stuff you've taken, which beliefs. I think it's a bit of an eyebrow raiser to deliberately spread Jesuit education type stuff to other people. But
yeah, usually not.
Depends what your other follower beliefs are, I guess.
Yeah, not usually a great plan.
Yeah, I think this is all coming down to what is your characterization of a good idea?
Yeah.
What is your goal exactly? And if the goal is to piss them off, do you care that they're pissed off? Are they going to be able to do something to you, which may not necessarily mean taking one or more of your cities either? But if you tick them off and then they start ganging up on you, either maybe they decide, can make proposals in World Congress as well. I'm going to vote to embargo you because you're a jerk.
Hmm.
You got to look at the bigger diplomatic picture here.
Yeah, it also sort of depends on how much pressure he's got on the capital. If Attila's court has a crazy amount of pressure on it from your own religion, because you have every other city around it covered, and it'll eventually shove it down, so you don't have to even bother trying to convert it. It'll get there eventually.
So you're in a very good defensible position to maintain your control of your religion over their cities.
Hmm. If an AI has founded a religion, no matter how crappy and whether or not they even still have it in their cities, they will always vote against your world religion, civ-based rather than what exists.
Or even if it still exists and they don't do anything with it at all. They're just, nope, I have a religion, you're proposing one that's not mine, so no. And again, if you don't care about that or they don't have a lot of votes, it's not going to make a lot of impact, then fine, you can let them whine and scream and moan about it.
Yep. It's just one of those weirdnesses with the religious system.
It actually sounds kind of human, too. But your religion is crap. Don't care. I don't like yours. But you founded it really late. Why do you place that much importance? Shut up.
Yeah, there should be a point where even AIs or players just, or at least choose not to found a religion, especially if they already have somebody else's that they like.
Yes, in which case they would choose, I could found a religion, or heck, why don't I just found this as a holy site and then get more faith that I can hopefully invest in the religion that is here.
How do you tell where a wonder has been built? By Kekos. Currently playing as the Shoshone, trying to invade China. China actually got the Great Wall.
China banned him.
And it's making his life slightly more difficult and annoying. He's opened up to the point offering cities for peace, and he was wondering if there was a way to tell which city had the Great Wall, to see if they could take that city and have a clearer shot at Beijing.
It's probably the capital.
Yeah. It's probably in Beijing, but...
He says, he looked in the diplomacy tab and doesn't say anywhere. That's true. Doesn't actually say where things are built in the diplomacy tab. Well, there's a couple things. One is, you know, when the Great Wall get built, it will tell you the exact city it was built in if you already knew about that city.
Yes.
So if you've actually seen the city, it will say it was built here. So if you aren't paying attention to where the Great Wall got built, when it got built, well, okay. That's a bit of an issue. After that, though, it's all about where the graphics are, because the Great Wall extends away from the actual city that it was produced in. So find the middle city in the Great Wall graphics, and it's a good shot at it. Otherwise, Philip Wiley basically says save and reload, because the Great Wall's borders don't extend unless you save and reload. So even if the culture border has moved or, you know, other stuff has happened, it doesn't actually change the Great Wall graphics on the map, which is kind of annoying. But if you save and reload, then you'll actually have the Great Wall graphics at the most appropriate distance. And then, yeah, find the one in the middle. Or use a spy. Go to a city and then you can look in the city.
Yeah. Or before and after that, you just zoom in.
Once you have the spy in the city and it's set up, it's...
Surveillance.
Yeah, which only takes one or two turns. You can find out what's actually in that city.
I do think for convenience sake, if you can see the map graphic at all, it really should show up in the list of cities with the wonders then.
Well, Great Wall's not in a city, though. It's out on the map.
I think if you took an experienced player and had him identify a post-discovered Great Wall, he could probably get the right city 50 times in a row.
Yeah, you just look. As long as you can see the city that it got built in.
Yes.
Because sometimes the AI likes jamming the second city right next to the capital, and then you don't
That's
know.
That's true. Then it might not be as one or the other. Obvious.
Interesting statistics. The Crazy Scott posted, here are some interesting stats pulled from the Civ 5 achievements on Steam. A couple of things to keep in mind. All achievements except those relating to mods don't reflect modded play, although only 15% of the players have played with a mod. This is counting anyone who has Civ 5 on Steam. 76.8% of players have discovered an ancient ruin, which basically you've played the game. 71.7% founded a second city, and 50.4% eliminated another civilization. I think it's fairly safe to say that about 23.2% of people who own the game haven't even started it up, or at least haven't gotten past the first few moves. Liberty is the most commonly completed policy track, 46.2%, followed by Tradition, 39.9%, and Honor, 38.7%.
I disagree.
39.8% of players have founded a pantheon, and 35% have founded a religion. Only 33% of players have used nukes, and 27% of players have fully explored the tech tree. 18.5% of players have downloaded a mod, while 15% have actually played with one.
But then to tie that second topic to the first one, which is talk about like the average Civ player, and the average Civ player, I like how the discussion pretty well focuses almost entirely around the difficulty level you play at, as opposed to, say, for example, what type of victory type you go for, but I understand the difficulty level sort of a thing. The percentages on that are...
completely inaccurate.
Well,
consider the skewing from a lot of people never even playing amongst this percentage.
And those who are playing, it's percentage of players who have beaten a game per difficulty level, which itself is askew because maybe the difficulty level you play on most of the time, all of the time, you've never actually won, in which case you would not be represented here.
I would also say that these are achievement-based things, so if you play a modded game, you will never get an achievement. And, well, frankly, you have to get the achievement.
Unless you achievement manage it, in which case you can get any achievement without doing anything.
Well, of course.
And that will show up here.
And perhaps you just played, for example, on Settler difficulty level in order to get the achievement and then never again.
Yeah. So that's the thing. It's like how many people have completed the achievements? Because I know I've actually had to go do each and every single freaking difficulty level just to get the achievement.
And I think sort of on the converse, you wonder how many people beat Deity just by doing just a tiny, you know, one-on-one and just rush the AI and say, hey, yep. I won on Deity.
Yep, versus standard size map.
Mm-hmm.
So. And then it also made the comparison of like players who are actively on the Civ Fanatic Center versus players that are not.
Yeah, that discussion came up about, oh, I think the average Civ player is Prince or King, but if we're talking about CFC, it's Immortal and Deity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even the CFC measure is also difficult because how many people visit CFC that never register an account, and how many people who visit CFC and register an account actually post anything?
Mm-hmm.
Even trying to ascertain what the average CFC, Civilization Fanatic Center, user plays and whether they're average. And then you also question, people who do post, are they a representative sample? Are they average? Or are they not average because they post?
Even amongst people who post, I think it's a pretty biased interpretation of what you can view on the forum to assume that most of them are Immortal Deity.
Yeah.
Just saying.
And then there's also a question if people are lying or not when they say, I won Deity. Oh, did you now?
Yeah. I would probably suggest that the actual average is somewhere between Emperor and Prince, even on CFC.
Yeah, I'd be willing to give them a level. I mean, I don't have any data to back that up, so I'd be willing to change my mind, too. But I'd give them, like, one level over the global average.
Now, is it the Prince level where it's dead even as far as advantages for the player versus the AI, or is
give
that
or take.
King? Okay.
Yeah, Prince is the middle of the road.
The middle, but it's not exactly perfect, I think.
Yeah, where the player isn't given more distinct advantages, the lower two levels as opposed to the upper three levels, where the AI gets even more dirt bonuses. It's as average as you're going to get.
I wouldn't even say Prince, really. Of the people who are constantly posting on CFC and reading and doing stuff, I would say that they're probably closer to Emperor Immortal ability, just because of all the information that's there, and people figure stuff out, post it, other people read it, and if they're good enough to incorporate that, then just the average ability goes up as compared to people who don't hang out on forums and just try and do it themselves.
Another added wrinkle, as if we needed more, are those who play on a difficulty level that really is too difficult for them to win consistently. Oh, even more qualifiers in there. But they enjoy the challenge. And then there are those people who, to use a golfing term, sandbag, and could do really, really well on a higher difficulty level, but prefer the lower difficulty levels because they like to win consistently, or they like to win more frequently or more speedily, and that's how they have fun. And again, he says, what difference does it make as long as I'm having fun?
Yeah, pretty much. And you have to think, like, not everybody wants to treat it like a puzzle, and therefore higher difficulty levels are more interesting to them. Over the years, there's always been people who've popped up and say, I can beat Immortal, but I refuse to play on Immortal or Deity because of all the extra bonuses, so I play on Emperor and don't sweat out all the extra requirements.
I would say that describes me, more or less. I'm an Emperor-level player. I've been for years, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah. He's like, I could move up a level, but it's kind of annoying, so no. I'm here to have fun, not to make Civ a second job.
And there's also other Civ-related things that I do that are not playing the game, so
yes,
there's some time sinks there with that. And I will say, as an aside, I think it came up in the first thread where some people started talking about MP. I'm not even going to mention the name, but it kind of really went off the rails when someone suggested that, well, if you're a good player at MP, then you're obviously unemployed because you have lots of time to play the game.
What?
It's like, wow.
What? No.
You could say that about single player, too. Well, the only people that win at Deity obviously are unemployed because they have lots of time to play the game.
Obviously.
Or underemployed, maybe. How dare you just assume you're just, it's outright employed or not employed.
I just don't. I'll put it this way. I question the immediate conception of time spent versus playability because it's wrong. There's some correlation there, but to get past a certain point, there's more to it than just playing a lot.
Oh, yeah. You could play 10,000 hours on Prince and not know how to actually play the game.
Yep. And some people do stuff like that.
Presumably because they're having fun.
Yeah, well, one would hope if you put in thousands of hours that you enjoyed those thousands of hours.
I punished myself by playing Civ 5.
Well, we're not, I wouldn't separate the enjoyment. Like, if you played 10,000 hours and you enjoyed it, that doesn't mean that you actually learned anything.
No.
If you played 10,000 hours of Civ and haven't learned anything about how to do stuff, then that's a completely different problem.
Yeah. But still, if they never went past Prince, this theoretical person probably would not be an effective deity player compared to someone who like put 100 hours into just being a good deity player.
I mean, quite clearly, what we should be working towards is that the average Civ player listens to this show.
Yes.
That's the true measure. I mean, we might as well come out and say it finally. It's whatever I'm thinking.
As our goal, that is not unreasonable, but that should be the reasonable average Civ player's goal. But the average polycaster's goal should be something like that, yes.
Actually, I just have to laugh. Delnar Ursiki, partway through page 2, responding to the math magician, who said, you know, I think people on here are making it look like Deity is impossible with a middle tier Civ, with the middle tier dirt Civ of belief that practically every Civ game is winnable. But then his response is the usual crap response about Deity. He says, Deity can be beaten with any Civ because the exploits you need to rely on. Oh, I just love when people throw the word exploit and then use it for everything. So you can use exploits with Iroquois just as well as with Poland. And I quote, worker stealing. Screw off. That is not an exploit. Exploiting the deal AI. Well, there's no exploit. It exists in the game. Seriously.
It's working as designed, guys.
Working as designed. Might be a bad design, but it's still working. Exploiting the fact that the AI doesn't choose optimal policy paths. Honor openers and ignoring rationalism, for example. Not every AI opens honor. A lot of them like tradition, which apparently, according to CFC, is the optimal path. Exploiting the fact that the AI doesn't choose optimal tech paths. Well, yeah, but players don't tend to do that.
I was going to say.
And like, at what point is anything but playing poorly on purpose not an exploit? I don't understand.
I have to completely derp, or otherwise it's not fair to the AI.
Yeah, exploiting how hesitant non-Gandhi AIs are to use their nukes. I'm sorry, I do not let the AI get nukes. And if they do build this stupid thing, I usually nuke the crap out of them so they can't.
All right, let's put it this way. The premise of that post isn't rational, unless they're using the dictionary definition of exploit, in which case you are trying to exploit as much as possible because it's good.
But exploit is a word in...
You can exploit resources. You can exploit something's inadequacies to win. And that's neither bad, nor is it the typical definition used in gaming. But it's the only definition that is used by this poster that could possibly be rational. So I'll just give him the benefit of the doubt and assume he was talking about the dictionary definition of exploit, because the concept of playing the game at all being an exploit is absurd.
Yep. Oh, instead of being able to mess around with odd tech paths like currency before writing, you're forced to use the same tired policy path? Okay. One, don't mix your tech paths with your policy paths. If you're trying to say something bad about something, if you're trying to say that you shouldn't go currency before writing, don't talk about policy choices at the same time. And the same tired tech build order. I will give that to it. To beat DD more consistently, you have to choose some slightly more specific paths. But that's also not exactly proven, because I've done multiple LPs where I've done different things that are non-optimal on purpose, but they still won.
And you could also just read through the DD challenge threads on strategy and tips and see that the information presented there is not consistent with this post at all.
Yeah, that too. people who've played on DD consistently actually know that there's more than one way to win this. There's a more optimal way, if that's really all you're looking for, is the fastest time. But if you're looking to just play and win eventually without caring about the exact win time, there's lots of choices.
Yeah, the higher difficulty level you go, there is, generally speaking, a smaller margin of error that you can expect to encounter and still be in a reasonable position to win, as in, oh, I get to this particular victory condition, and then it registered as, hey, congratulations, you have won this particular type of victory, and on this particular level, achievements unlocked. But it also depends on, again, going back to when you're playing on a particular difficulty level, is your goal to win as the game defines it, or is it just not to rage quit? Or in my case, say on deity level, can I go like 100, 150 turns without dying? That'd be great, you know? It just depends.
Yeah, it does depend. Like, if you are trying for fastest win time, then yes, you're very limited. But you know what? Higher difficulty levels should be harder to win if you just screw around. So.
Well, yes, otherwise, why have difficulty levels?
Yes, there is some AI incompetence, but you're also going to see that on Prince and Emperor and blah, 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 blah.
Recorded for episode 226 of Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Mad Jin, and One Crazy Canadia.
Zeppelin Air posted a little thing about refugees and immigration, because every war results in a mass exodus of its citizens. Well, not every war, maybe, but exodus of its citizens to safe havens. Does not need to be due to war, of course. Bad economy or natural disasters can also result in a refugee crisis of neighboring nations. What I did wonder was how this could be represented in Civ 5 or Civ 6. It seems too important to be missed out, and it could be used as a deterrent for too much war between nations. Well, we don't have to worry about the disasters so much, since we don't have random events.
Okay. Not every conquest is the Mongol conquest, and most conquests in Civ are on the scale of dozens of years in the early game and still many years in the later game, to the point where modeling this would be problematic, because max exoduses that are temporary would have happened and come back inside a few turns.
Or even within a turn.
So like the old war weariness thing from Civ 4 kind of sort of modeled this. I don't know if you need much else. I don't think it really, I don't know.
Well, okay, how about this? When you take a city, half the population just up and disappears.
That's true.
Where'd they go?
True. Are, they didn't is all everybody get running killed.
Around? So, and there's a lot of angry people, too. So that's true. It is abstracted reasonably well as it stands.
But they didn't go
yeah,
anywhere.
They, yeah, I know. They evaporate into thin air right now. What if it's a size 6 city you take and it goes down to 3? What if one or two of those missing population points isn't the casualties, but it goes into another city nearby or across the border into another civ?
Yeah. What if they moved?
You have starvation. You have civs benefiting at random from other wars. I don't know that it adds a lot to the game. You could do it. I don't think it'd make much difference, so it wouldn't hurt much either. But
I mean, it would help with push population. Now, granted, if Civ 5 had citizen-specific data set, kind of like more like Civ 4-ish, where the
the
citizens individually had religion and the citizens individually had a culture.
And if it was still too much culture to their culture as opposed to yours,
all of a sudden you have a war and Civ A is pushing Civ B's population into Civ C.
Yep.
And you're just kind of shoving the population forward, kind of like what happened when the Huns wrecked Rome. And we wrecked the tribes and did the great migration to shove them all into Rome.
Yeah, there's two AI players or a human player and AI player going, you're sitting over here as player C and going, thanks for the free pop, guys.
Right up until your empire falls because you have too much of their free pop.
Yes,
and they don't like you.
Yeah, without the culture part, I mean, at least.
Yeah, if you tied that sort of thing in. But then you could also tie stuff in, actually, Noah, not the Ark. With the double X on either side, because you have to have that. Talked about emigration mod in there, where it does something similar, but also revolves around prosperity. So if your population's starving in a city, instead of dying, there's no food here. I'm going to that city, which actually has food, and move that way. Or if you don't produce enough local happiness, then the people in your city might head over to a place that does have local happiness benefits, and then move that way.
Which may or may not be a city of your own.
Yeah.
Mm. It would be interesting. It's a little odd in an abstraction of 20-year terms, but I wouldn't be opposed to it.
Yeah, you'd have to put more emphasis back on the citizen.
Yeah.
In-game. And then, yeah, you could have, say, the Great Migration exist in-game, which did take place over a long period of time, so it'd be fine in the game. But then you'd also want to have government policies or other such things for handling those things. So do you have a government that says, we don't like you. You can stay over there in that refugee camp and get out of our territory because we'll kill you if you show up. Versus, sure, come on over. Everybody together. We're all happy.
Together. Yeah.
You can add more depth to the game related around that. Not a bad concept, but you'd have to change the game to make citizens important and then modify a lot of mechanics around it.
And so then the question becomes, would all that effort be worth it?
Sure.
Yeah, if it was
done well.
So this is definitely something, let's try to put it into like a next Civ title as opposed to try to backfill into an existing title because so much would have to change. It's not one of those, let's just add it as an existing system and then it plays well with the other mechanics because there's a ripple effect. It's substantial enough for it to be meaningful and not just be just shoved in there.
Yeah, especially if you go back to military units requiring a population point to make them. And then the question is, hey, look, I'm using all these culture Y people as my military because that happened in reality. Mm-hmm. We don't want to use our people for it. We're just going to use yours.
Yeah, here, you guys go over here and do all the dying things.
Yeah, that's a great way to do that. Except then they all turn around and then their loyalty becomes questionable unless if you start becoming unhappy, unless they were completely merged in. Maybe you can make the unique units of a civ if you have their population, and they had already made it to that tech.
And in that city or cities where they have the presence.
Yeah, obviously. Would not be good for casual players, though, I think.
Why am I losing all my stuff?
Why did all my military units turn around and declare New Russia?
Mm-hmm.
What's with that?
You could have consequences of not playing with that well, of course, scale with difficulty. So the newer players, more casual players, would be on the lower difficulty. So like with anything else, it wouldn't penalize them as much. Feedback on the last episode.
Yeah, feedback.
Yeah, episode 229, we had Derek Paxton, also known as Kale, when he was doing mods. There's something they actually did, not directly related to him so much, as to us talking about, it's a relief to hear all you softies go edgy on the tech trading part. More of that, please. For example, when you touch on the Rising Tide new diplomacy system, yeah, in vanilla it's broken, but you leave it at that? Come on, don't be as bland as the future discuss here. And Rising Tide, the Aquatic Expansion, where's the excitement, the disappointment? Is this the expansion you'd hoped for? But some of that got cut, as Dan noted to that poster.
Yeah.
But apparently they like it when we disagree. So here, you just got some more disagreement.
Well, I think your feedback is bad. Take that.
That's not the kind of disagreement they were asking for.
Oh.
Softies? Me? Maybe I really am getting old.
And frankly, to be fair, we really don't know enough about the expansion to know whether or not it's to be excitable or disappointable.
Yeah, that was the other part of my response to Ruben as well. To make a truly informed opinion, on top of the fact that we don't actually have it to play yet, always short of that, we still need more information. And actually, as we're recording this, we're less than a week away from E3, where apparently there's going to be Civilization Beyond Earth Rising Tide information that's new. It's promised. I don't know if it's going to be realized, but we'll be talking about that on the next episode.
Yes, we will all very much be totally excited to call it Civbert from now on.
Oh, that came up. Someone did not like that. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Like, guys, like, but Civbert, no, no, just no. Why? No. And I made the point, well, I said, first, the acronym flows from Civilization plus Beyond Earth plus Rising Tide, but we weren't the first to use it, though, and I doubt we'll be the last. So.
Yeah.
We're just reflecting what's in the community. You know, we're using terms that people are becoming familiar with, whether you like it or not. And you can make the argument by the fact that you point out that you dislike it is going to help ensure that it sticks around.
Yep. If you keep bringing it up,
you tell us it's terrible, therefore we're going to keep using it.
And more people are going to talk about it. They're going to see the negativity, so they're going to understand what the term is more quickly than they would otherwise. So, yep, it's just self-fulfilling. Well done.
And it brings up relational thoughts about Qbert. And and maybe that's an aspirational model. Maybe Civbert can become like Qbert, i.e. a good game.
And seeing as how Imagine has again brought up Qbert, I'll bring up Civerni will again be the second expansion pack for Beyond Earth. So I guess the question is, in order for it to become Ernie, that's going to be a really long...
Okay, shouldn't it be Civ Bernie?
Yeah, it'd be Bernie. Oh, God. Are we going to... No. No. Weaken at Bernie's. No. It's dead and we keep dragging it around and pretending it's still a game.
Oh!
Ouch!
Oh, that was
whoa!
That was entirely your fault. I blame you for that.
No
thought.
No, Imagine. No, you know whose fault it really is.
Whoever made Weekend at Bernie's.
It's the fault of the people who killed the game.
Now, Phil, doesn't a game have to be alive first before it can be declared dead? Well, that was dark.
Oh, man. Let's not get into politicast here, Dan.
Okay, Dan.
And then in the second thread, Utico is like, really appreciated you guys managing to snag a developer for Galciv 3 for the podcast. And yeah, Derek Paxson had been on the show before as Kale, as well as Merg, but he was just coming on in his new capacity. Dan's questions are really helpful and really sold me on their product. Looking to getting the game in the future. Thanks for this special podcast episode. Stormtrooper, who says, that was a sweet episode. Galciv 3 definitely sounds worth picking up. One question does bother me, though. Is there a definite shift from history, Civilization, to space sci-fi settings, Beyond Earth, starships, etc., also from Firaxis? Or that's just the current trend and stuff like Civ 6 will be the best ever? My response was, I don't see this as a shift, but rather a growth. We've got a return to extending the Civilization series, you know, thinking Alpha Centauri, but more of an extension of the scope for the 4X turn-based strategy gaming that we were talking about before.
Yeah, I don't know if he's talking about specific to Polycast, or just does he think that there's a shift from historical-based strategy games to space-based?
I think the latter.
Yeah.
I don't think we're that important in his life yet, unfortunately.
Okay, but is there a shift? No, because both of these things have always been around. Civ, Mu have all existed at the same time, and then games have been...
back then in the space.
I know,
stuff.
But other ones have been built and yada, yada, yada. I'm thinking just like the turn-based strategy game stuff. So lots of games have been built. What the current trend is that there was a huge void, to say, of turn-based strategy games built in space. Mostly because Mu 3 failed so badly, everybody wanted to stay away from it for a while. But lately, in the last 2-3 years, there's just been such a massive push to make more. It will probably subside, but series like Galciv been around in a couple versions for a long time, so it's not really a surprise that Galciv 3 came out. Things come and go, and all three, like fantasy, space, and historical, have always existed.
You're still going to get historical ones. The sci-fi ones are not taking over. It's just that since a couple have been moderately successful, hey, let's make that.
Yeah, that too.
With the Rising Tide announcement, it was made clear from the co-designers that this is a franchise, not just a one-off title, and you could infer, so maybe not just expansion packs, but does that mean there'll be like a Civilization Beyond Earth 2 at some point? And it's hard to predict the future, but again, these are companies trying to make money. So if it's making money, ..
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that point, maybe is part of trying to separate it from connection to Alpha Centauri, which was a one-off, versus, like, had Sid managed to keep control of Smack, would he have made Smack 2 alongside of Civ 4?
And it's an interesting question, because that was Brian Reynolds spearheaded that, and then he left Firaxis. So maybe if Brian Reynolds had stayed at Firaxis, perhaps then maybe there would have been a Smack 2. But
yeah, his intent is that it's supposed to be a franchise, which means there should be a Beyond Earth 2 and 3 and 4, if they're lucky enough to not kill the franchise before it even gets a chance.
Recorded for episode 229 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian team, Mad Jin, and Derek Paxton.
The Rising Tide expansion for Beyond Earth.
Is this really an expansion level amount of stuff? I guess it depends on how much. I mean, 4 new factions?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not just 4 new factions. We need more details on all of that Rising Tide is going to introduce.
Well, no, my point's more on the... one of the biggest failures for Beyond Earth was the fact that they only had 8 factions.
Well, see, and I would have said that it was hard to distinguish between the factions, regardless of how many numbers there were.
Yeah,
but, okay.
But on top of that, you heard the same 8 things every single time. So there was no replayability in Real Civ.
Yeah, they were a little bit generic leader 2.0.
I'm sorry, did you just say unlike in Real Civ?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm glad that this expansion isn't just 8 new factions. It is way to play and new content. And it does seem pretty substantial to me. The new biomes are really cool.
Yeah,
it feels like an expansion.
Mechanical depth is definitely attractive. Because more than the leaders, I feel like that's where Beyond Earth was lacking in vanilla. On release day, you built cities and spammed trade routes like crazy, and you won the game.
Maybe the leader traits that they're talking about, maybe it'll make it feel like there'll be more than 12 factions.
But I have some concerns, because how does this translate into like a multiplayer setting versus not multiplayer setting? If you have political capital, how are you getting it? How are you changing diplomatic relationships with political capital if a human player is the person you're changing the quote-unquote relationship with? That's a bit of a snag in my mind. It's hard to do that kind of thing well.
I assume that it wouldn't be just personality traits, because it affected the player too. That it would be things like, if you've declared war on 3 players before turn 100, then you're going to get a trait for Warmonger, and Warmonger increases your fear stat, and fear stat causes other AIs to react to you differently. But it may also give you some bonus in game, like plus 10% attack to your units, something like that. So there would be a gameplay impact to it too that could fill in those. That's how I read it, but I completely that's just off the top of my head.
Something that came up in the PC World article and is being picked up already in the Civ community, where Hayden Dingman writes, "It's all but expected with the Civilization series at this point. Base game, decent if stripped down foundation. First expansion fixes some of the gripes. Second expansion, hailed as a masterpiece every single time." And I think, well, I don't know about every single time, but in recent Civ history, there seems to be a pattern. And so some people are already speculating, so whatever Rising Tide doesn't have in it will be in the next expansion for Beyond Earth, right? And some people said, whoa, 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 where are you getting this from? Well, what Will Miller said to Rock Paper Shogun in an interview was, "We have a long-term product plan at Firaxis. I can't comment on what exactly this looks like, but when we set it to make Beyond Earth, the idea was to make a franchise. You're seeing us committed to that franchise, committed to that idea with this expansion, and with the patches to the base game that we released afterwards. I think it is a sort of a foregone conclusion for us. This kind of echoes what happened with Civilization V." And then he reiterates, "We released it, had some problems, then we patched it, we released 2 expansions that really brought that game up to what people know and love today. We're in the process of doing that with Beyond Earth."
I don't know, there was far more patching on Civ 5, like substantial patching. Not saying that it was more broken or anything, I'm just saying like they actually spent the time to patch constantly big patches that fixed things or just changed mechanics in between the expansion development, whereas Beyond Earth got like a couple minor XML tweaks, and then they went to the expansion.
I wonder if that's because Civ 5 was a new engine that they had developed. And, you know, so when you do that, you're going to have more issues. You know, the AI was being developed for the first time and coming out in Civ 5, where Beyond Earth did inherit a lot of good bulletproof tested systems that it could build on. So it didn't need that level of support afterwards.
Oh, no, it did need that level of support. It did.
Yeah.
There was lots of stuff that probably should have been done in a patch. And some of it is starting to pop up here in the expansion.
Yes, not as many patches for Beyond Earth as there was for Civ 5 in between, you know, base game.
And it was fast in between release.
And that too. And some people, of course, are saying, so how come Rising Tide just isn't a patch? It's available for free with Beyond Earth.
Some people are. I mean, now granted, there is more stuff in here than I would expect in a patch.
Yeah.
Like a lot more.
Yes. But
yes.
Implemented correctly, this does look like expansion material, certainly. But that's only if we're actually getting some depth in these mechanics, which, I mean, we'll just have to wait and see. But there's nothing that, when you look at this list, you're like, oh god, you know, how could they possibly make this into an expansion-worthy amount of content? It's not like that. Looking at it, I feel like, yes, you easily could.
And there's also some balking at suggested retail price, too.
Also, look at that release date. Autumn 2015.
Yeah.
Okay.
The base game came out autumn 2014.
Oh, yeah. That's not even a year in high expansion.
Yeah. And with the minimal patches going on, and when you build out a lot of content, it usually takes time.
Yeah.
So do you feel like an expansion a year after the game's release feels like it's too short? Like you would want more time between those things? Or what are you saying?
I'm just thinking from a production standpoint. Volume of potential content versus actual time to build that content and test it.
So in other words, the announcement of Rising Tide is helping to explain at least in part why we haven't seen as many updates to Beyond Earth post-release as we did for Civilization 5, where the time between Civ 5 release and the first expansion was 2 years.
Yeah, except that in that time, there's a lot of patching and development. But personally, just looking at the code and all the releases from Civ 4 through all its expansions and Civ 5 and all its expansions, I just have this feeling that Firaxis just doesn't quite understand, or maybe it's 2K pushing too much, how to actually timeline a project so that they actually build what they're planning on building and have it actually built and finished and tested before the release date.
I wasn't that involved with Civ 5's expansions. I was with Civ 4 quite a bit, and I just remember Warlords, as I recall, was 9 months after Civ 4 came out, and then Beyond the Sword was 18. Like, they kind of planned to do 2 expansions in 2 years, and they kind of made that decision to pull Warlords up a little bit, and so they'd have more time with Beyond the Sword and kind of balance that out. But I think there's an amazing amount of work you can do, because so much of what goes into making these games is base-level engine stuff, and once you have that all working, it's amazing how productive you can be with that expansion. So just my personal opinion, a year for that expansion sounds really good, because you get to focus just on the content there. You don't have to worry on base game. You can inherit all that and you can just move forward. So assuming they have a similar size team, there's a lot that you can do in a game in 1 year. You look
at we know that they haven't been working on it since release. They spent a lot of time doing the victory lap.
Well, yeah, but it's not the full team that's doing the victory lap, I'm sure. I'm sure that the designers go and talk to people and things like that. But these are big teams of people that are working on these projects. If you look at Beyond Earth, I don't know how long it was in development for, but assuming it was 2 years, maybe 3 years of development time, then you could say, well, the expansion is getting half the time of the full base game, or one third of the time of the full base game, and that seems considerable.
I don't know. When this comes out and it's full of bugs because things weren't tested?
Yes.
Yeah.
Then we can retalk.
That's more my point.
Basically, you're calling out their project management history.
Yeah.
But that's not easy stuff to do, and the training for it is separate from programming, for certain.
Well, obviously.
I mean, I've had a little bit of that as part of my graduate work, so I have a pretty good conception of how fast and how easily things can go wrong on you. But yeah, I mean, they do have a consistent track record of not budgeting that properly. I would agree with that.
And this part of the conversation is drawing me back to another comment that Will Miller made to Rock Paper Shogun, which is that Rising Tide is what we like to call a Firaxis-style expansion, which means in addition to putting a lot of content into the game and balancing and polishing, we also put new systems into the game which fundamentally change how it plays. And I think for some people, and to Imagine's point a little bit, we would like the balancing and polishing to include the new systems that change fundamentally how the game plays, in addition to what needed balancing and polishing post-release of the base game to the expansion. in the Brave New World expansion that there were some fixes that were included in the game in Brave New World. But for people who did not want to get Brave New World yet or at all, there was a patch that was made available for those that had the base game and Gods and Kings.
Yeah.
So that it wasn't just, so hopefully that itself would be included. But yes, it would be nice to see that after Rising Tide comes out, then have to have so much of a balance and polishing patches as opposed to perhaps tweaks. It's less reactionary. Yeah. Like, this works well, but wouldn't it be nice if it was expanded on X, as opposed to, this doesn't work, how come this wasn't caught before it was released? Which all gets back to the timing of, yes, given the spacing here between the release of Beyond Earth and Rising Tide, just how long has Rising Tide been in development? Who's been involved? What's the process been? Etc., etc. All of that's, we don't know.
I don't know. Like, some of what you're referring to as polishing seems like bug fixing to me, rather. Yeah. And I'm not sure I would put that under polish. Your first priority has to be that the game works, right?
Yeah, no, not game companies. Blending the bug smashing with polish.
Extent of the bug, I guess. Yeah. Like, if it crashes you to desktop, then that's not really polishing.
No, that's not polishing.
But, if there's, like, a graphical error that occurs only when you do X or Y, okay, I mean, whatever. That could definitely fall under polishing. Yeah, I think balance is a lot harder, because even if you have a wide array of skilled people testing the game, stuff just comes up once you put it out to the populace.
Players always come up with some little exploit or something that the developers never think of.
Once you have thousands of iterations, you see that one thing is stronger on average than your other options too consistently. So you might tweak that. But I'm a lot more concerned with the design, like having meaningful choices at each stage of the game so that you're not just doing the same cookie cutter things over and over again. And having those choices be different enough from each other so that it's fun gameplay first, and then we can look at balance and say, okay, doing this too much is too strong every game or whatever.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think that that's a good way to go. Let's go for making the game great and then come back around and then address any points that ambition cost us.
Yeah, but it's got to work first and foremost. It has to work.
It has to work. But anyways, I think to Dan's point, Firaxis has a history of whenever they put out an expansion, they will patch the base, like whatever they fixed of the base game or the previous expansion, they will put out as a free patch. And they have always done that.
Yes.
Not like Paradox. Where you have to buy the DLC just to get the fixes for the base game. Yes, I'm calling out Paradox on that.
I mean, perhaps in summary, also from Will Miller being interviewed by Alec Meir at Rock Paper Shogun, quote, "We're not a studio that releases one-and-done products."
Wait.
And I would say, maybe not with Civ, but there's some other Firaxis titles.
Let's see.
We're not a studio that releases one-and-done Civ products. That one maybe you could believe.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Woo, kale. And not that horrible vegetable that everybody's eating.
It's like lettuce. Yes. It's tasteless. Why do you care about kale, Mackie?
Because
it's
everywhere.
Complain too much, I'm going to make you some kale cookies.
Ew. No.
Congratulations, Phil. You're making Mackie think negatively of cookies.
Actually, there are such things as kale chips, so it's not that far off.
Yeah,
you could definitely do kale cookies.
It tastes like green.
Green
Green's
has a
not,
flavor?
Like, fundamentally yes. bad. If you eat, like, a Granny Smith apple, that's very different.
Although, technically, the Granny Smith apple is only green on the outside.
That's true, but it's green. It counts.
So next time on Yumcast,
we'll go with kale.
Well, they are. I'm not participating if they're doing that.
Well, it's a new luxury resource they're adding to the game.
Kale. Oh.
I'll give you kale for sugar.
Well, the developer named kale might be.
I believe we are coming up on the best before time for this episode.
Right. Get out.
Out of the floor.
You can do better than that. Now, whether you will, it's another question, but you can do better than that.
I don't want to. Anyways, this has been episode 230 of the Polycast.net. I have been joined by our usual co-host, Makalua.
I can go back to racing now, yay!
The Mian team.
I am the poster man of trustworthiness.
No.
Dan CQQ.
I think you're listening to Polycast too infrequently.
And of course, we were joined by our guest today, Carl.
I'm going to go eat some kale.
Bye, everybody.
Record date June 13th, 2015. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.